Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Oh yeah, man, I should have wrote up a blog entry. Well, I was busy getting turned down. I'm trying to invite people to come on the goddamn radio show. Well, Jonathan Landay is going to be here. I guess if you can only have one guest, should be Jonathan Landay. He's really good on Iraq, always has been. Ever since, I don't know what he was like before September 11th, but ever since right after September 11th, when the war party made it clear that Iraq was next, he started doing good journalism on the subject. So, anyway. I guess we can talk a little bit about that. Mostly I want to know what he thinks about what's going on there now. Lots of important breaking news on the Iraq war front, including a currently running battle at the Baiji oil refinery. Boy, ain't that kind of important who runs that thing, huh? All right, well. So Landay will be here, and you know what? That may be it. I think, I don't even think I have any invites out. I think I've been told sorry no by everybody. Except tomorrow is going to be great then, because tomorrow we'll have Jonathan Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute. And we'll have John Neffel from Rolling Stone. And then Monday we're going to talk with Dar Jamail again from now writing at Al Jazeera. And then, let's see, we got, I'll try to get Ramzi Baroud for tomorrow. I like that guy. And then, Hornberger still owes me one. I have to, you know what, I may try to get back with him sometime today. Oh, and Trevor Tim, too, is going to be on, next Monday with Dar. Oh, I better write Dar here next to Tim. Dar. My notes, they're pretty unorganized. Anyway, so, yeah, you know. Oh, no, well, I guess I won't have Rutherford tomorrow. Maybe next week. I don't know. Well, you might as well tune out now. No, I'm just kidding. Landay's coming up. You might as well tune out an hour from now after the Landay interview, because otherwise it's just going to be me talking, and just because I'm good on everything doesn't mean you want to hear it. I don't know, maybe it does. Some people like it. I'm not sure why. I kind of don't. But you never know. All right. Well, that's okay. We will not have a show of dead air today. I've got plenty to talk about, including, of course, Iraq, Somalia, Iran, and other things. Other things. I guess, first of all, top news from antiwar.com. Top story, poll. Americans overwhelmingly oppose a new war in Iraq. Check this out. A new poll from Public Policy Polling shows overwhelming opposition among American voters to a new U.S. war in Iraq, with only 16% supporting the idea of sending combat troops, with 74% against. Now that right there, I guess, I don't know, 60 obviously is a supermajority. 75 would be better. Then I think you could legitimately say a super duper majority. But I don't know. How about anything above 70 is a super duper majority? That seems fair to me. 74% say absolutely not. So that's pretty good. Not that it necessarily is going to have much effect on what the government wants to do. They say they don't want to send combat troops, but they're sending the special forces to advise. And they're sending the Marines, I think, for embassy security, only they're sending hundreds of them, right? Anyway, it's true that on the news, they've shown some clips of ISIS guys clad in black driving trucks down the road, but that's pretty much not their standard operating procedure. It's not like you could just send the military in there and just find them in their giant convoy, wipe them out in a couple of big battles. And the American people don't need to be told this anymore. They've seen the war for the Sunni triangle in Iraq for a decade. And they don't want it anymore. They never did defeat the Sunni-based insurgency. They only bribed it to stop fighting for a while. The American people would be absolutely nuts to support going back to war over the consequences of the last one. I mean, they were nuts to let the Republicans do this back in 2003. But right now, and especially all these Republicans saying, oh yeah, Obama, we hate Obama, he's a traitor, he's a Kenyan, he's a Muslim, he's a usurper of John McCain's rightful throne. Yeah, we want him to lead a war into Iraq. And damn him for not doing it. Really? This guy who you detest more than Bill Clinton? Who deserves to be detested more than Bill Clinton even? Well, I don't know. Actually, Bill Clinton probably killed more people than Barack Obama killed. Although Barack Obama's killed a lot of people in a lot more places than Bill Clinton. But Bill Clinton, he really blockaded the people of Iraq to death by, you know, almost as many as George W. Bush killed, I think, you know? So, it's a tough call. You got to make the judgment call yourself there, I guess. Out of Clinton, Bush, Obama, which is the worst butcher of innocence? How do you measure, really, in piles of skulls? They're roughly equal. I think Obama's in third place so far, actually. His destruction is more widespread, but limited in nature, in its own way, so far. But anyway, the American people, if it counts, the American people have said no. Don't do it. Now, I don't know if the poll said, what if we sent a fleet of remote control planes? Would you care then? I'm afraid what the answer to that might be. Justin Raimondo has an article today at antiwar.com where he says he doesn't think that these ISIS guys are a threat and so we shouldn't do anything about it. I think they are a threat, so we shouldn't do anything about it. I think that America's war in Iraq is what created this mess in the first place when, of course, Saddam Hussein had one interest with Al-Qaeda and that was killing him. And that was why Zarqawi was living up safe in American-backed autonomous Kurdistan before the war. That's why the Pentagon wanted to kill him before the war, and that's why Bush wouldn't let him kill him before the war, because he needed to have a terrorist enemy excuse for the war. He needed a talking point for Colin Powell's lying speech to the UN, which was there's this guy named Zarqawi who met bin Laden one time, not that he was loyal to him, and something Saddam Hussein. What he meant was Saddam Hussein has an all-points bulletin out for this guy. If you find him, kill him, he had ordered the mukbarat. But, oh well, anyway, Saddam, something, something, Zarqawi, something, something, Osama. So there's your connection to Al-Qaeda, claimed Powell. So Bush wouldn't let the Pentagon kill him before the war. And then after they invaded and overthrew the secular, clean-shaven, well, he had a mustache, but still the point remains the same, if you get the point, green uniform rather than robe-wearing fascist dictator. And fought their war to put the Iranian-backed Shiite parties and their armies, the Badr Brigades and the Mahdi Army, in charge. They created, and with their El Salvador option using the Badr Brigades, they created Al-Qaeda in Iraq as the reaction to their war in the first place. And when they're not creating them as a reaction to their occupation, they're outright backing them, as Obama has done in Libya and especially in Syria. So the only answer is to just stop right now. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium.
and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, you know, sometimes the breaks, they interrupt me right at a spot where I would have rather kept talking. Because I guess, you know, to some people, especially if you're some kind of conservative or nationalist or whatever, what I say just sounds naive. Like some hippie singing, give peace a chance or something. So, if I could try to state it a little more succinctly. Premise one, when we fight a war over there, we just create more and more and more of these guys. Premise two, when we outright support them, like our government is doing on the other side of the former border there in Syria, why, that just makes matters worse also. You know, Bill Clinton actually had a theory that he stated back in the day that, you know, by helping the Bosnians in the Balkans, well, that'll prove to the Muslims around the world just how much we mean it, about how much we love them, and so they'll never want to be terrorists against us again. And I guess it didn't matter that he was murdering 1 million Iraqis from bases right next to the holy sites of Mecca and Medina on the Arabian Peninsula, or that he's backing the Israelis in their permanent occupations of southern Lebanon and Palestine, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Mubarak dictatorship in Egypt, and the kings of Jordan and Arabia and whatever. But no, that Bosnia thing's going to really win them over. I don't even think anybody's dumb enough to try that argument about backing the crazies in Syria. They just back them and then claim that they're moderates. Like John Kerry claimed in testimony to John McCain last summer. Oh, yeah, no, the rebels in Syria? Yeah, no, the vast majority of them are secular and moderate. And the whole room was like, come on. Well, I'm trying to remember now if the whole room was in my head or not. I know I'm repeating myself. I need to go back and watch the YouTube. Hey, chat room, you guys got the YouTube of that? Does the whole room break out in laughter? Or was that just me and you? When John McCary tried to push... John McCary. Same damn thing, right? My neurons got crossed and man, told the truth anyway. Yeah, as John Kerry and John McCain were sitting there pretending to be telling the truth about their lies. And so that was premise one, premise two, kind of drawn out there. So then conclusion, just back off. Just don't do anything. But really, I should build in more premises. Here's what I really think. Rather than just not bombing Iraq, America has to absolutely and completely abolish the empire and disengage from the Middle East entirely. And if this fight is to have to be fought, even if it is all George Bush's fault, I mean, I guess you could parachute the neocons in there. I don't care. That'd be fun. The people who actually were responsible, you know, the individuals most responsible for the war. But otherwise, they're just going to have to fight it out. It sucks, but there's no point in propping up bubbles of power for people who don't really have that popular sovereignty to support them. If the Maliki government has to fall, fine. That's just tough, and I don't think it will, probably. I think the army will be backed up enough by the militias, and, you know, the Ayatollah Sistani said, hey, fighting age males, if you can, go join the army and help. That's the vehicle that he didn't say go join the Mahdi army. He said join the Iraqi army. So, you know, I think that institution is going to last. Whether Maliki lasts or not, it seems like the form of this government may last. But if not, those are the breaks. It has to sort itself out without us there. And even if the very worst characters in ISIS, those who most prefer crucifying people in the town square and you know, massacring women and children in the marketplace in order to provoke reactions by the Shia and whatever, even if that's all going on, the most important obligation, the only obligation of this government, if it is to exist at all, which I'm opposed to, but supposedly is protecting the lives and the rights of the people of this country. And, you know, when you look at the case that there were only a few dozen of these guys, and now there are thousands, due to our government's intervention this whole time, it's only right to insist that they stop intervening. If they support the Sisi dictatorship, they engender terrorist attacks against the United States. If they support the revolution in Syria, they're engendering terrorist attacks against the United States. If they support the Iranian militias now, intervening against the Sunni militias and ISIS in Iraq, they're engendering terrorist attacks against the United States. Backing dictators, backing revolutions, bombing for Iran, this side or the other, whatever they're doing, they're putting the American people in danger. They are only making matters worse. And in fact, making matters worse for whoever side they're supposedly taking too. I mean, if you think a bunch of, fleets of drones backing up the Quds force in Iraq is going to crush the Sunni insurgency that the American army could not crush in all those years of war, when there were 150,000 troops there, 130,000 troops in the country, then, I don't know. Go vote Democrat some more, I guess, which is what you will do. Otherwise, and the truth is, and I've seen this narrative getting out on CNN and other places, and I think it's correct, that even if they're trying to play it smart PR, that really, these Al-Qaeda guys are real jerks. They crucify people to death, and that's part of their thing, is to, you know, to prove how brutal they are, that they'll never give up, they'll always fight, and they want to pick worse and worse fights and reactions out of the Shia and out of the Americans, too. So that's part of their thing. But in doing so, and I think that they just can't realize this, they're like Republicans and Democrats. They can't see their own cruelty for what it is, and they can't imagine how other people see it either. And so I think that everywhere ISIS goes, they end up undermining their own rule and authority. I mean, here they come in, they have the might to say, hey, we're in charge here now. But then they turn everyone against them immediately. And I think we can count on that for the long term. I think that's part of being a bin Ladenite, is you're a piece of crap. Treat everybody like crap and make them all hate you. And so, good. It's a self-defeating kind of a project of theirs. The Islamo-fascist caliphate is not sustainable in the 21st century whatsoever. So, now that we have the ISIS, do we want them in Western Europe and the United States? Or do you want to keep them isolated such as they are, at least on the other side of Turkey from here? They used to be stuck in Afghanistan. Not only that, on the eastern border of it. Then George Bush brought them, 1,500 miles to the west, and now Obama's brought them even further, all the way into Syria, to the Turkish border, into Turkey, really. Turkey's backing them, too. But anyway, so you want to keep them there, or you want to bring them this way? If you want to bring them this way, send in the drones, send in the Marines, send in the escalation, outright declare your side with Iran in making this thing worse. And now, at the same time, of course, I'm all for making peace with Iran. But I'm not for making war with them, not against them or with them. That was George Bush's policy, putting the Badr Brigade in power in Baghdad. There's no reason to, that's what, created a lot of this mess in the first place. No reason to keep that up. Anyway, I have a feeling Landes may say something different about what should be done, but he's also got some reporting to do, too. So Jonathan Landes from McClatchy Newspapers in just a minute. And then a lot more news on a lot more different subjects today, too. ScottHorton.org for the archives. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our guest today is Jonathan Landes from McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thank you very much.
Good. Well,
good to be back.
Happy to hear it. And you're welcome, and very happy to have you here. Appreciate it. Now, I want to ask, well, who knew about the situation in Iraq, but not in just a kind of flippant way? I mean, it's important to me, I think, that you get credit for being one of the few mainstream newspaper reporters who, and I really, I mean few, who did not just go along with the in crowd, basically, the way they did, and helped to lie us into war back in 2002 and 3. In fact, you were reporting the truth about the agenda to push us into war with Iraq beginning in the fall of 01. People can find those archives there. You and Warren Strobel, too, there at Knight Ridder News Service back then. And so that's very important. People can watch all about that in the PBS Bill Moyers documentary, Buying the War, which is still online and which is really great, that I hope y'all will look at. So that's important to bring up. But I want to get to, and I haven't gone back to review what it was that you wrote back then, Jonathan, lately here, but I wonder whether much of it had to do with what are going to be the consequences for the Iraqi people who, at that point in the American debate, were largely imaginary and weren't apparently going to have a say in how any of this happened once the war happened. And then I wonder if also you could just, you know, talk about people, other people who knew. I mean, I was just a skater, cab driver, nobody kid doing pirate radio, and I had read a stupid Tom Clancy novel where Saddam Hussein gets assassinated and the Iranians inherit the south of the country in the snap of fingers, right there. So I had that much knowledge that there's some schism going on here and some things might take place, and I was just driving a cab in the middle of the night. So I wonder what the best and the brightest that you were talking to in D.C. were really saying when they weren't lying us into war.
Well, indeed, one of the first pieces we wrote when we actually reported my former colleagues, Warren Strobel and John Walcott, reported, I believe it was in February of 2002 or January, that the administration had decided to invade Iraq. And we started writing pieces. I wrote, remember one anyway, a major piece on here are the possible consequences. And they included taking the lid off what had been centuries of enmity between the Shia and Sunni branches of Islam, that Saddam, who was a Sunni and presided over a Sunni-dominated minority regime that suppressed the Shiites in the Shia in Iraq, that taking the lid off that pot could be extremely dangerous in terms of igniting sectarian violence. And indeed, you know, fast forward a couple years, and that's exactly what happened. The fact is that what also happened during that time, after the American invasion, was the creation of an entity known as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. This was an Al-Qaeda branch that had not existed prior to the United States invasion, and that was the forerunner of the group that is now on an offensive, the Sunni terrorist group that is now on an offensive from the north of Iraq towards Baghdad. They're about 60, I believe, about 60 kilometers south, north of Baghdad now. That was the forerunner, that group. And indeed, throughout this entire period, Iraq has not known peace. There was a period, several years ago when, you know, the level of terrorist violence was low, but nevertheless it was never wiped out. That group never went away, and the idea that somehow Iraq was calm and peaceful when the Bush administration handed the tiller over to the Obama administration is just pure nonsense.
Yeah, well, it's amazing that those are the goalposts of this narrative here. The argument being played out, especially on TV, is, whether we should have stayed, whether Obama should have forced Maliki to let him stay and all that kind of thing. I mean, never mind that. But
well,
predictions.
But my response to that would be, how? When you had the fact that George Bush in 2008 signed an agreement with Maliki, by the way, Shiite prime minister, that the United States helped put in power in a deal with Iran that pushed aside Iyad Alawi, who was the Iraqi politician who had actually won parliamentary elections. We helped put Maliki in power, and he one of the last things that Bush did when he left, before he left office, was sign this agreement with Maliki that that specified, mandated, a U.S. withdrawal, all troops out by the end of 2011. Obama comes into power, and he tried to negotiate an agreement with Maliki that would have at least put kept 3,000 U.S. military trainers in Iraq. And granted, the fact is that the U.S. military wanted to keep more troops there, wanted a bigger troop presence. But here you had a government, a Maliki, and his parliament, and others, and Iran, that were saying, no way are we going to let shoot any U.S. troops stay behind. And that would have been a deal also that would have been rejected by the Congress, because it would have required U.S. troops to, but what Maliki was demanding and what Obama was refusing was that U.S. troops who stayed would be subject to Iraqi law, whereas the Obama administration was saying, no, they need to be exempted from Iraqi law, and U.S. troops need to remain subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That would be the U.S. Uniform Code of Military Justice. So those negotiations collapsed. So the idea that keeping American troops there might have staved off what this disaster that we've seen unfolding since last week is also revisionist nonsense. Because the fact is that you had an Iraqi army that was up in the north, that was Shiite dominated, and that was not getting along with the population there. The population was incredibly came to oppose the Iraqi army presence in the north. And the fact is also that you still had this terrorist group, ISIS, or some people refer to ISIL, that was operating not just in Syria, but was still operating in Iraq.
All right, so, well, there's a lot to go over here, but I guess, first and foremost, what do you think the U.S. is going to do now?
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see, because of one of the ironies of this disaster is that by intervening on the side of the Iraqi government, which has now asked formally the United States to stage airstrikes against ISIS, the United States effectively finds itself on the same side as Iran, and effectively finds itself on the same side as the Syrian dictator Bashar Assad, because Assad is fighting ISIS as well. Don't forget, ISIS spans the border. They control parts of northeastern Syria and a large part of Iraq. And so, I mean, it remains to be seen what's going to happen. But the fact is, it's quite an extraordinary situation. The United States, I don't think, can change the facts on the ground through airstrikes. We'll have to wait and see. And usually when you mount airstrikes, you need eyes on the ground to spot targets or to laze targets. And that could mean, I don't know if that means necessarily putting U.S. Special forces on the ground. We have to wait and see. But certainly what the United States has been trying to do, and Iran apparently, is trying to push Maliki to reach out to politicians from the Kurd, leadership of the Kurds, leadership of Sunnis who are opposed to this takeover by this terrorist group in association with former Baathists and tribal militias, to try and put some, somehow rescue some kind of multi-secular
Iraqi. All
right,
we'll be right back. Jonathan, we got to take this break. We'll be right back.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers about the continuing war in Iraq. And so right up against the break, we were talking about the coalition they're trying to put together against ISIS now, which includes the Iranians. And I think it's notable. Yeah, hey, it's definitely notable. It's quantifiably notable that America's been fighting for Iran and Iraq since 2003. That was exactly what the king of Saudi Arabia said was, hey, it was all, it's in the Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning WikiLeaks State Department cables. It was always you and us and Saddam against Iran, but now you're going to hand Iraq to Iran on a golden platter, he said. And
That's what happened.
And in 2003, I mean, it was, I think it was March. It wasn't even April. It was still March 2003 when the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Badr Brigades crossed the border from Iran back into Iraq.
I was there. I watched them come across. I was in Kurdistan when they came
across. Take it from there, Jonathan. Sorry.
I was there. They came across into Kurdistan. Well, I was. It was actually. Let me think. It may have been somewhere in March. Yep.
And so that's the catbird seat. That was it. The Iranians had the opposition prepared. Whatever Chalabi had promised Richard Pearl was null and void that day.
Right. And the fact is that the Iranians probably played a much bigger role secretly in sucking the United States into that disaster by sponsoring or at least putting up some of Chalabi's quote-unquote defectors on whose garbage information and bogus intelligence the Bush administration relied in part. Don't you remember, ice cream and yogurt trucks the biological biological weapons labs disguised as mobile milk and yogurt trucks.
Sure.
Well,
Colin Powell had a very convincing cartoon of what one might look like if they had had a picture of one.
Right. and you know, the fact is that people have forgotten all of that, or they seem to have, and those people include, unfortunately, television cable news bookers.
Well, you know what
Jonathan,
who put
these people on the air again, have revived them, and they've gone on the air to spew revisionist garbage.
Yeah, well, TV never told the truth. TV never put up a map and said, let's talk a little bit about Sunni and Shia and who's cleansing who from Baghdad right now and this kind of thing. Who's on whose side? They never talked about that. It was always just the democracy versus the terrorists or whatever, the whole damn war. They would never be honest. So, of course, they don't know anybody who knows anything about it to interview because
did. That's not true. I mean, Scott, there are a lot of people who understood what was going on, who understood the disaster that we were getting sucked into. They were talking to us. That's how we were able to do the reporting that we were able to do.
No, I don't mean that. I mean the cable TV news people doing the booking. They don't know who you are. They've never met you or heard of Knight Ritter before or anything like that. All they know is, well, that Wolfowitz guy is the genius, right? What do they know
I don't know
about
that
it?
They consider him a genius, but they look at the name. They see, oh, look, he's the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. Let's put him on. And the most egregious is the Wall Street Journal op-ed editors who fail to police the historical trash that is being revived or being printed on their op-ed page.
Yeah. It is. It's really out of control with the what's going on in the media right now, where even Judith Miller, I read that Judith Miller was featured on Fox to complain about the media coverage isn't being warlike enough on this issue.
Apparently she was on. I saw a screen grab. I did not bother tuning in to listen. Because should be on. None of them should have any credibility at all. To the extent that they should be presented to the American people again.
All right, now let me ask you this.
After what they've put this country through.
Well, and what they've put Iraq through, and there's still so much to cover here, Jonathan. Let me ask you this. It looks to me, just from the map, like, and I'm not saying either side necessarily recognizes it the way I recognize it, but I wonder, it looks like a stalemate to me. It looks like Maliki, you know, he's been shelling Fallujah angrily for a while. He's not really trying to retake Fallujah after all these months. His army turned and ran, like you said, because they're the Shiite army. They're the army of the country from Baghdad to Basra. They're not really the army of the eastern part of the country. And I wonder whether, you know, it doesn't. And with Baghdad being an 85% Shiite city now, ISIS guys can't be fool enough to think that they can really take the city. They can suicide bomb it. They can't really take the city back after the Army and the Marine Corps gave it to the Shiites. So you know, is this just the Declaration of Independence? This is now the end of Maliki pretending to be the government of the North and the West, and this is now the end of the Sunnis pretending to go along with this awakening crap where they're going to participate and be allowed to participate in the government in Baghdad.
But we'll have to wait and see, because I think you're, I mean, you're right. I mean, the fact is that the weight of the numbers alone mitigate against any possibility that ISIS is going to be able to quote-unquote, conquer Baghdad, although, you know, no one really expected them to conquer Mosul either. But there's a couple of other considerations here, and the one I would point you to is the fact that ISIS has declared its intent to destroy the holiest shrines in Shia Islam, which happen to be located in Iraq, in Samarra, in Karbala, and in Najaf. Mm-hmm. Those are red lines for the country on the other side of the border, Iran. And I don't think that there's going to be a situation. I don't think Iran is going to allow or will brook any kind of possibility that these shrines are going to be destroyed by these Sunni extremists. And I think you would certainly see, if there was a danger of that, I think you would see active Iranian military intervention, although let's not forget there are numerous news reports for days now that the head of the Quds force, General Soleimani, who, by the way, was the architect of saving Bashar Assad, is now doing the same for Maliki.
Mm-hmm. And now, what about the primacy of the tribes over ISIS? The Black Banners get all the headlines, but isn't this the same old Sunni insurgency, and aren't they still the major power, the former Baathists and the local Sunni tribal leaders, et cetera, rather than this Baghdadi guy?
I think so. I mean, I haven't drilled down far enough into all of that to be able to say one way or the other, but the fact is that you know, certainly there are a lot of Baathists involved, former Baathists involved, and once this is over, if it's ever over, I think you're going to see these groups falling out with each other, because ideologically they're diametrically opposed. You've got Baghdadi and ISIS, which are extremist Sunnis, and you have the Baathists, who, let's not forget, were a secular political party that ruled Iraq and with a pretense towards the end, you know, with this sort of pretense towards Islam, but in fact we're secular, and I don't see how they are possibly going to be able to coexist once, if they ever get to the point where they conquer and secure a large piece of territory. We'll have to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, when it comes to ISIS and the al-Nusra Front, which I guess is still back in Syria and sitting this part of the thing out here, can you give me ballpark numbers of how many guys? I hear different estimates all over the place, and I'm curious to know what you think.
You know what, Scott, I think any information that comes out of Syria regarding numbers, that kind of thing, is going to be, you know, speculation. I don't think we've seen numbers in terms of the number of foreigners who are involved in ISIS. I've seen figures, estimates of 7,000 to 10,000. I don't think anybody really knows. You know, I just got back from Syria. I just made my second trip there, and the fact is that the insurgency, or at least the Islamists, are battling each other, and for the time being, Bashar Assad has won.
Nusra and ISIS are fighting each other there.
Yes, Nusra with Arar al-Sham and the FSA are battling ISIS. Although there was reports the other day that ISIS has asked for and obtained a ceasefire. I forget exactly where it was in order to fight the regime, push back a regime offensive, while it is also tied down in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now, so here's where I play Pollyanna for just a second here. What about if they can make an Iran deal? And there have been some, oh man, bumper music. Well, here, let me dump that down. We'll be right back, everybody. I'm going to keep recording you for just a second here, Jonathan, if that's all right. Into the break here. We got this Iran deal, which I don't know. I like to give 60-40. What the hell? Why not? Of a chance of a final nuclear deal here. And there was talk from, I don't know, one or another Saudi prince or so-called minister of government who said, you know what? Hey, if the Americans want to lead the way on warming up relations with Iran, we could be cool with that. You know, let's do that. And obviously, there's no consensus there about it. But it just seems like it's such an obvious thing to do, not to necessarily ally outright with the Badr Brigade again or anything like that, but at least to, you know, end the Cold War with Iran, which then pulls the rug out from under this entire crisis of the Shiite Crescent by making it no longer a big deal that Iran is friends with Syria and Hezbollah, etc., because Iran, they ain't so bad anymore, kind of a thing. And then it seems like maybe that could help really take the pressure off the Saudis to do so much funding of the Mujahideen in Syria, Iraq, and everywhere else. And, you know, maybe things could be a little bit better around there. But I guess I'm way down a slippery slope argument.
Yeah, I think you're way down the road right now. I think you're way down the road. I think that neither side is looking to really make any kind of major deals outside of the nuclear deal, and then to say, okay, what next? Because you still have a serious, you know, you still have, first of all, domestically in both Iran and the United States, you have domestic political opposition to any kind of not just nuclear deal, but I mean, not just you know, a deal on Iraq, but the nuclear deal and any kind of deal dealings. But then there's also there are also other questions, especially about, you know, at least as far as the United States goes, you know, Iranian sponsorship and support of Hezbollah and Hezbollah. Terrorist operations that have targeted people in Europe and Latin America, and I think we're a long ways off from sort of like this, you know, grand bargain, because I don't think the United States is prepared to support any kind of continued Iran, you know, to be seen to support any kind of continued Iranian support for Hezbollah, which is the sworn enemy of Israel.
Yeah.
So right. I think we're way down the road on that right now.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I think that's why the Leverts always say we need to kind of make an overall peace first and then deal with the individual issues the way that Nixon and Kissinger did with Mao, taking a piecemeal, because it makes it so difficult to get any of them done while all the rest of the issues are still outstanding. But
right, but don't forget also that once upon a time, 2000, and I'm trying to remember I don't want to get my date wrong, but I want to say 2005, I think it was, there was an offer from the former Iranian government of Ayatollah of Khatami. It was an overall package deal that would have included a deal on the nuclear program.
Yeah, 05.
That was rejected by who?
The E3 negotiations of 03 through 05 you're talking about. Right.
And it was Dick Cheney who said no, who put the kibosh on that.
Right. Well, let's, the reason I'm so that hopeful about it, I know I get carried away, but the reason I'm so hopeful about it is it seems like the nuclear issue is the major outstanding issue. Not that Hezbollah is no big deal or anything, but it seems like if we could get this thing out of the way, then maybe we can make that next step. But without getting this thing out of the way, it seems like it'll always be the endless threats of options on tables and all that crap, same as always. So, anyway.
Right.
But thank you for your time. I've kept you way over time. I really appreciate it, Jonathan.
Anytime, Scott.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
I don't know. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Yeah, I don't always get along with the Heartbreaks very well.
He shot down my whole idea that maybe we can start getting along with Iran now. We meaning, you know, the American Empire. He said, to paraphrase, don't be silly and naive and stupid, little bunny rabbit. So, anyway. But damn it, the nuclear issue is the big fake outstanding issue between America and Iran. Why can't we work it out? Let's work it out. I mean, who wants to be friends with an Ayatollah? Not me. That doesn't mean we gotta be their enemies. For Christ's sake, man. Just because they overthrew an American-backed sock puppet dictator, we gotta hold a grudge? They're the ones who got the right to hold a grudge, not us. I talked to a guy not long ago. Oh, he was repairing the air conditioner in my truck. And he was against all the foreign intervention and all the wars and said he always had been. Even after September 11th, he wasn't going for it. Just leave him alone. Stay the hell out of there. Blah, blah, blah. But the Iranians, they hate us. Boy, the Iranians, man, they just hate us, he said. And I guess everybody's always got to have one. And I don't know, am I especially curious as a human being that I wonder, well, how come? I mean, maybe it is, you know, like the power nightmares, that they just don't like jazz. Or maybe America backed a fascist murderer dictator to be their dictator for 25 years. And then backed Saddam Hussein's invasion, which killed 500,000 of them or more, and included the use of chemical weapons after they succeeded in overthrowing that dictator. But no, we're the ones with the right to hold a grudge because hostages. Give me a break. And that was when I was a toddler. And I'm pretty damned old now. Too old to trust, that's for sure. So, meaning I'm in my 30s. You know, all year long I thought I was 38. And then it turned out I was only 37. And now I'm almost 38. Which at least I get 2 38s, but I would have liked to have been 37 for a while. You know, I hardly know what it feels like. It's almost over. Such an idiot. Anyway, who cares about being enemies with Iran? Why do you got to be enemies with Iran? It's so retarded. And over their nuclear program that never was a nuclear weapons program. When that is the big outstanding issue, and it's a big fake outstanding issue preventing our government from having a rapprochement with theirs, then screw that, man. Come on. Get it worked out. And the Iranians have made it clear that, listen, we'll jump through all your hoops. Just let us do it in a way where it's not the most humiliating thing that ever happened to humans before, and we'll go along, okay? If we can't take that as good enough, then damn. Come on, there. You know, in fact, here, I'll get factual for a minute to spare you and me the burden of continuing on with my rant. What is the quality of scientific evidence against Iran? Asks Yosef Butt, the nuclear physicist formerly of the Federation of American Scientists. Now, director of the Emerging Technologies Program at the Cultural Intelligence Institute. Huh. Anyway. Blam! Yosef Butt is a genius. He's a scientist, and he puts together a scientific, mathematical, geometrical sort of a case against the case of Iran's nuclear lawlessness. It just ain't so, he says. And he goes through point by point. Let's look at all the worst accusations. You want to talk about the alleged studies? Gareth Porter and Robert Kelly seem to think that they were forged by, obviously, the Israelis and funneled into Western intelligence by the Mujahideen cult, communist terrorist cult. And then next, and he goes through, and this amounts to, it's really an attack on all the so-called evidence against Iran and their nuclear program, but amounts to just a complete destruction of David Albright from the other ISIS. They're not the suicide bombers, but they may be more deadly. The Institute for Science and International Security in Washington, D.C., where they come up with all this alarmist crap. And so he goes through. Oh, they're not in compliance. Yeah, but on technically what? All that was resolved, and none of it had to do with saying that they were making nuclear weapons. As he says, South Korea and Egypt were both in technical violation of their safeguards agreement from time to time, but that didn't even necessarily mean deception, and it certainly didn't mean they were making nuke bombs. Give us a break. Same thing here. And then he goes through, yeah, here's some intelligence, the graphs of, oh, they were working on nuclear bomb stuff. Well, if they were, that wouldn't be illegal under the safeguards agreement under the NPT if they were looking at paperwork about it. But anyway, it was obviously forged. The math didn't make sense. And anybody who knew about nuclear bombs took one look at it and started busting out laughing. And it was completely and totally debunked at the time. And then next, the magnets that Joby Warrick in the Washington Post ran with in February 2013. Nope, turned out a bunch of crap. As Gareth Porter shows in his book, Manufactured Crisis, they had another use, and they were used for that use at a major university there in Iran, as the IAEA documented. And then he goes through about the Parchin military base, and oh yeah, they must have been doing high explosives testing for nuclear warheads there, except it was total crap and there was no evidence of it at all. And all their innuendos about, oh look, they're spraying the ground with a garden hose. That must be their awesome, effective way of covering up particles of nuclear material, huh? Look, pink tarp, garden hose. And then they had a whole conspiracy theory about a Russian scientist who had no nuclear, nuclear knowledge or expertise whatsoever. He was an expert making nano diamonds, but they tried to rig it and combine it with their spin about Parchin to say that they were testing nuclear bomb implosion systems there, which is ridiculous, and that's not how you do it anyway, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is completely debunked again by Gareth Porter and again by Robert Kelly, formerly of the IAEA. And formerly of Lawrence Livermore Lab, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then he quotes even Ali Heinonen, the very hawkish former IAEA head of safeguards, who's now at Harvard. And he's actually helping Robert Kelly and Gareth Porter in the debunking of that one there. And then, yeah, lots of Robert Kelly debunking these accusations in here. Good stuff. And then, oh, he brings up David Albright saying, passing on the same kind of innuendo about Iraq back in 2002, September 10th, 2002. Is activity at Al-Qaim related to nuclear efforts? Ooh, satellite images show something, something. I bet maybe Saddam Hussein's trying to make nuclear bombs, everybody, said David Albright. Of course, wasn't true at all. They made a big deal about the exploding bridge wire detonators that, again, are dual-use applications and have been proven to be put to use in those other uses. They don't have to only be for nuclear bombs. And, for example, they're used in drilling for oil, etc., other industrial purposes. Again, this is Dr. Yosef Butt at armscontrollaw.com. What is the quality of scientific evidence against Iran? And then he goes through and he talks about, is this even in Iran? Oh, I guess this, oh no, this is in Pakistan, but it's just calling Albright out for a major error in estimating the capacity of an Iranian nuclear reactor. The truth is, David Albright is not a nuclear physicist, and he's not a former IAEA weapons inspector either. He likes to represent himself as both, but as Gordon Prather, an actual nuclear physicist and a former nuclear bomb maker for this government, says, David Albright has always been a fraud. Well, here's all his innuendo destroyed by Yosef Butt today at armscontrollaw.com. It'll run on anti-war tomorrow.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, it's the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network here, noon to 3 weekdays. I'm on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. On Sundays, I do Liberty Chat on Tuesday nights. Last night, I talked with Doug Bandow and with Todd Pierce. Bandow about the crisis in Iraq, etc. Pierce about, the legal underpinnings of a totalitarian, lawless military police state here in the United States of America. If not the full-scale implementation of those policies yet. Groundwork certainly has been laid, as described by Todd Pierce, former Judge Advocate General, defense attorney at Guantanamo Bay, major in the U.S. Army. Retired. You may have heard him on the show before. He's definitely worth listening to. And they'll have that up on YouTube, I think, and at libertychat.com. And I'll post it in the interview section eventually at, Adam will, at scotthorton.org. And by the way, scotthorton.org, scotthorton.org, scotthorton.org. Patronize my sponsors and click on my archives. I got full archives going back to 2003, more than 3,000 of them now. And you can listen to any and all of those. And then I got a blog and I got some documentaries. I got the chat room. Stop by the chat room. Hey, chat room guys, how's it going? A free year of something. I don't know what I get free for a year, but I'll take it. Get something free for a year. ScottHorton.org/chat if you want to do that. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And by the way, if anybody wants to call in the show, I'm just going to be sitting here ranting and raving, but I'm happy to take your calls on any and all these issues. Sure, you have important things that you and interesting things that you think and want to say about it, or whatever the hell you want. I don't care. I should come up with a question of the day and all that entertaining radio crap, but I don't really want to. I'd rather just cover the news and you guys chime in whatever you want. The number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And I put that number in the chat room too. Here, I'll post it in there again in case anybody's just showing up. 512-271-4836. Again, scotthorton.org/chat if you want to hang out in there. All right. So, let me see. I should have decided during the break what I wanted to talk about next. But I didn't. So now I'll decide on the fly. Do I want to talk about Somalia? No, I think I want to stick with the Iraq thing for just a minute. No, I don't. Do I? I guess I can get back to that in a minute. I hope I made my case, kind of okay before against intervention. I'm not going to argue that ISIS is no threat to the West. Here's why. I think that they would be fools to not attack the West. I mean, obviously I don't want them to. I'm just saying from their point of view. If they can get America back to war in the Sunni Triangle, then so much the better for them. Who do you think made them badasses in the first place? America gave them a war to exist in, to thrive in, and to attract allies from all across the Middle East, a whole new generation of fighters. Why wouldn't they want to replicate that? And especially if it remains true, as it did back when bin Laden and Zawahiri put this thing together, that the far enemy, the USA, is still bankrolling all the local dictators that are keeping all their allies down across the region. Even if we are helping them in Syria. Maybe there's one exception. And in Libya. Nah, even in Libya they got the counter coup now. If that remains true, then their strategy seems like it's still a good one. Replicate the Afghan war against the Soviets, replicate the Afghan war against the Americans, the Iraq war against the Americans again, bog us down, bleed us dry, radicalize a new generation, train up a new generation of fighters on their side, bankrupt all the local dictators in their political support and in their finances at the same time, and move forward. You know, just because American politicians are thinking about this week doesn't mean that's how everybody in the world thinks. And so for the ISIS guys, it only makes sense for them to try to provoke the French into invading, to try to provoke the Americans into invading, anybody that they can to come and, you know, turn that place into lawless jihadistan for that much longer. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's wrong. Maybe they want to consolidate what they've got. Now they're conservatives and they want to maintain the state that they have. But it seems like they've only got a couple of few 10,000 guys. Not even. They got one 10,000 guys, right? I think that's one of the higher estimates. So I think that they're coming. And as the media has been admitting here and there, even though they're still basically covering for the Obama policy of backing the rebels in Syria, they keep admitting that, you know, sure are a hell of a lot of Westerners who've gone to Syria to fight. And I think it's just a matter of numbers. And I'm sorry I'm repeating myself, but what the hell? I mean, I can't think of anything that's more important than this right now, other than our relationship with Russia always, but still. It's just a matter of numbers. And it's just a matter of the ease of somebody who, look, think of one of these terrorists as basically just, I'm not saying on your idol's moral level, I'm just saying, of, you know, the parallel of their job. They're special forces guys, they're spies, behind the lines, and they can do a lot of damage. I mean, you know, it doesn't take much imagination to figure out how Al-Qaeda, how ISIS or whoever, if they could get into the United States, could attack a nuclear power plant, could attack a ball game, could attack a theme park, could attack Manhattan again, could attack DC or do something in such a way as to create major turmoil again. It wouldn't have to be 3,000 dead. Just think about Faisal Shahzad, the wannabe Pakistani Taliban who tried to blow up Times Square but failed back in 2010. His truck fizzled, and it was a local Muslim working in Times Square who tackled his ass and hailed the cops and had them, you know, handcuff him and take him away. But what if that attack had been successful? And by the way, he was a happy American citizen with a wife and a house and a professional job and a degree and all of that kind of thing, making probably more money than I'll ever make in my life anyway. And then he went home to Pakistan, and he saw the results of American drone strikes on men, women, and children over there. And he joined up the Taliban's fight, the Pakistani Taliban's fight against America. That was their one and only attack against the United States on our territory, was Faisal Shahzad. And he said to the judge said, how could you do that? Try to set up a bomb in Times Square? Women and children everywhere? Oh, I'm sentencing you to life in prison, you son of a bitch, you know, kind of rant. And Shahzad said, your drones don't differentiate between women and children, so all I'm doing is what you're doing. I'm not saying that justified it. I'm just saying how that provoked it, how that kind of thing works, but you know that. Segment's already over. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm reading about the cops murdering this old man. I mean, there's one of these every day, right? It's funny how society adapts, you know? Used to be everybody would always just joke about prison rape and all that. Oh yeah, part of your sentence if you're a criminal and you go to jail is you get raped. Ha ha. Whatever jokes people would make about that. I think it became less funny as people became aware more and more that most of the people in there really didn't do nothing. It's all just completely arbitrary and capricious, like the lawyer on Seinfeld. I don't see many jokes about cops killing innocent people in their backyards. You know. I don't know. Nobody does anything about it either. I'm not really much of an anthropologist. I kinda wish I was. I'm curious, I just don't know how to draw conclusions. But it just seems like, well, it just goes on every day. Oh, what these cops did was they came in this family's backyard while they were having a barbecue, and then they murdered the great-grandfather, and then they all got away with it. Just like always. Every single day in America, the cops murder some innocent person. Somebody who, at worst, they can try to characterize as violating some offense against the state, rather than actually doing anything to anyone. Every day they kill somebody. And I guess it's always been this way, but it used to be they just killed black people for sport because they could get away with that. Now that they can get away with killing anyone they want to, they kill anyone they want to, too. And they have complete impunity. And the worst thing that ever happens to a cop who murders somebody on the job, on the clock, is that they might get fired. For the grand jury to indict, for the prosecutor to urge the grand jury to indict, hey, we think that this was outside the law, man. Indictable crime here, you can't do that. For that to happen is one in a million, and you know it. If you can think of an example where there's even attempted accountability, then you know it's the exception that proves the rule. They might as well be the Mukbarat, and we're the Iraqis. They can just do whatever the hell they want with us. Come in our backyards and murder our great-grandparents if they feel like it. And what are you going to do about it, they say, like a schoolyard bully. Oh, I know. You can file a petition and ask Eric Holder to come to your aid. He'll protect you. I know. You can get together with your neighbors and elect an attorney general for your state, a district attorney for your county who's not the worst criminal in your state or your county. But I guess, no, you can't. Your neighbors won't help you with that. Your neighbors apparently just don't care anymore. I don't know, man. This is crazy to me. It's TV is what it is. Endless propaganda, this Law and Order Special Victims Unit and all this crap. The only thing standing between you and a private criminal butchering you to little pieces tonight are the public criminals. Every single day these shows are on, all day long. But in the real world, you know, if you have Facebook, that's all you need, right? I don't even have Facebook anymore, but I still see the results. But if you have Facebook and you have more than a few dozen friends, you'll see it in your feed every day. Oh my goodness, look at what the police did to this innocent person. If you have Facebook, every local police murder becomes a national news story. And you start thinking, holy crap, was there an official declaration of war against us all? That everyone who is not a cop is just game in their sport? What the hell is this? Cop shoots unarmed great-grandfather at family picnic. Faces no consequences. Of course he faces no consequences. He was on the job. I think it's hilarious when I see, you know, or not the crime part, but the results part. When I see a story, cop beats his girlfriend to death on a Saturday night, you know, because of the steroids and the drugs and the meathead. And indicted, may do at least a 6-month suspended sentence or something for murder, you know? Murder one, 6-month suspended sentence for you, cop. And I think, you idiot, you should have clocked in first. Then you could have cut her into little pieces and eaten her, and you still would have gotten away scot-free. 2 weeks paid vacation. Clock in before you wantonly murder people that you hate and want to murder. Cops, what are you, stupid? Saturday night, when you're at home enjoying an episode of Special Victims Unit, no, man, you could get in trouble for that. Years ago, I heard a caller to the Shannon Burke Show in Austin, Texas, and the caller was a former Williamson County sheriff, and they're notorious for being the meanest and most corrupt sons of bitches in all the state of Texas. And I know that because I'm from here. And this guy was from there. He was one of them, and he called the Shannon Burke Show and said, well, he retired because he just couldn't stand it anymore, and he finally got out of there. But one of the things that really did it for him was he was a trainer. Whenever the new cops came on, it was his job to ride around with them for a week or two and, you know, see how they are and if they're all right and train them up a little bit and this kind of thing. And they always gave, he always asked the same question, why are you a cop? And they always gave the same line of crap, oh, I just want to help people and blah, 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 that he never took seriously, but that's what they all say, so what are you going to do? But then he says this one guy, you know, brand new deputy sheriff, answered him plain as day, no problem about it. Truth be told, way I see it, things around here are getting more and more Gestapo, and I want to make sure I'm wearing a brown shirt. Because that's the way it is now. It's a war of the government against the rest of us. And so he decided, well, hell, I'm getting on the brutality side of the line, dude. I'm going to be the one swinging the club, firing the rifle, rather than the one with the knot on his head or the bullet in his heart. Because, you know, these are the kinds of decisions that family men are left to make. And if you already like pumping steroids and you're already a meathead and a bully, then why wouldn't you? You are the Milgram experiment, man. You'll do whatever they tell you. So go right ahead. They'll give you a shiny little badge and everything. You'll be the most official position in town. Everyone will call you sir. And then you'll kill their great grandparents and get away with it just fine, too. This article is at policestateusa.com. Cop shoots unarmed great-grandfather at family picnic. With impunity. And laughs. No, faces no consequences is actually the end of the headline. And I'm sorry, I know I was talking about terrorism and the ISIS and this and that, but then I was reading about them murdering this great-grandfather. And I thought, well, you know, I feel like complaining about that. So, that was what you got. And now, as far as what I was saying about ISIS attacking here, I think they will attack here, because I think strategically for them, it makes sense to attack here. Because the American, if they do, it'll just make them more powerful. And I think that our government sucks bad enough. They may even want it, but they certainly are going to be unreliable at best when it comes to being able to prevent that kind of thing. After helping to build them up one way and then the other in Iraq and Syria all these years. Like a bunch of cops.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good. Investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. So, yeah, I'm not being very concise today. Yes, I think ISIS is a danger. And I also think that's exactly why not to do anything about them. Because that's exactly what they would want, would be for our government to do something about it. And that's the best way to turn them against the United States. And the thing is, you know, screw a bunch of terrorists. I'm not saying that America should negotiate with them or give in to their demands, but our government has no right to maintain a world empire in the first place. So, what a great coincidence that that's the number one best way to stop encouraging people who would want to come and attack American civilians for, again, just that purpose, provoking a reaction and getting us to intervene more. Seems like that narrative is actually breaking through a little bit into the mainstream about the purpose of terrorism being to provoke a reaction. Well, what did you think? Oh, you didn't think. You're just scared and let them think for you. But the purpose is to provoke a reaction. So quit reacting and start being smart. That was what I was saying in 01, but no one wanted to listen to me. And I guess they couldn't listen to me unless they were pretty close to the local antenna at the time. Anyway. So, I think there are, you know, probably around 7,000. If there's an estimated 7,000 to 10,000, I'm going to say 7, maybe fewer, but still. That's a lot of guys if you can get them organized and shoot in the same direction and stuff. That can do some things. It seems like some of the reporting out of the Middle East, and I don't know how much of this is reliable and what, but it seems like quite a bit of narrative is coming out that, come on, now there's a, this one is called, it's a tribal revolution going on. Says Ali Hatim al-Suleiman, emir of the Dulaim tribe. He says the tribes, not ISIS, are in control of Mosul. And I don't know whether that's true, but sounds legit. They used a bunch of, you know, lunatics who execute the family members of their prisoners just to make their point and all that to scare the army away. Then why wouldn't they do that? Doesn't necessarily mean that ISIS is in control. Then again, you know, right now they have a compromise. As Jonathan Landay said, these guys are going to end up splitting and fighting amongst themselves. Just as they did back in 2006, 7, and 8. And all of that. But anyway, I guess it remains to be seen whether they try to really march on Baghdad. They'd be crazy to. I don't think they will. I have to assume that the Sunnis are basically going to break off the so-called Sunni triangle. And by the way, and there's an article about this that I haven't had a chance to read yet in The Guardian, but it's regarding the sectarianism in Iraq and the narrative that, oh, you know how they are, the Sunni and the Shia. That's true, there's a history of fighting like the Catholics and the Protestants, but you couldn't say now that, oh, you know how they are, the Catholics and the Protestants always killing each other. Well, actually, no. You know. Same thing for Iraq. Now, it's true that the worst of these guys, like the leaders of ISIS, they are the kinds of guys who murder people for so-called blasphemy. They are a bunch of religious nutballs, basically. Remember they shot that 14-year-old kid for saying, oh, come on, I wouldn't even give a discount to Muhammad. To one of his customers at his little roadside stand. And they said, what? Did you say something about Muhammad other than, hell yeah, Muhammad? Blam, and they shot him right in the face. Even though he really didn't mean any offense at all. He was just saying, hey, sorry, no discounts, not even for Muhammad. He was just talking about his no discounts policy. That's all. Poor kid. Anyway, and as Patrick Coburn has gone on at length, a lot of times they go, you know, they're not so much interested in even fighting Assad and his guys. They rather butcher Shiite and Christian civilians in Syria. So that's true, but that's the most radical edge. And that's not the history of all of Iraq. It's, and, you know, the problem is with language is things get oversimplified a lot. To say that what's going on is a Sunni versus Shia war is right, but it's not that they're fighting over who believes what. It's not that they're fighting over, oh, I hate you so much because your interpretation of the Quran and how it should be followed is different from mine. I regard your, you know, religious inspiration as polytheism and blah, blah, blah. That's not what they're fighting about. What they're fighting about is territory. What they're fighting about is we and they, us and them, and led by their various political factions. And so, yes, on the craziest edge, they're fighting over who believes what. But that's not inevitable. It's really American intervention that's made it that way all along. Well, that's really created all the sectarian fighting all along, and then has led to a situation where now the most radical religious type motivations, you know, are animating the guys on the ground doing the fighting. Which, in fact, you know, strategically speaking, is probably stupid for them, you know? But it's probably good for us that they take their eye off the ball in order to pick fights that they can't win. You know, that's how they lost Baghdad. They wanted to fight this civil war. Well, they lost the civil war. So, I mean, not that they ceased existing after that, but they sure as hell lost Baghdad. And they didn't have to. Well, maybe they were going to lose it one way or the other once America invaded. But anyway, I guess we'll see how long this guy Baghdadi, you know, quote-unquote, rules this part of Iraq or the Islamic State. I'm betting not long. I'm betting that the local Iraqis are going to reassert their sovereignty here. I don't mean Maliki and his government. I mean the local religious authorities, Baathists, and tribal leaders in the Sunni, predominantly Sunni areas in north and western Iraq. Just like during the Awakening, only without the American payoff. But they just showed that, eh, these guys are, you know, we'll tolerate them when they're useful and we'll get the hell rid of them when they're not useful anymore. So, anyway. And then I wonder about the al-Nusra front. They said, I think Landay said they're still fighting. Nusra and ISIS are still fighting in Syria right now. But I don't think that'll last. I mean, assuming the gains of ISIS in Iraq last, it seems like the al-Nusra front is going to end up having to merge with them and fight under their authority more. Just because of the realities on the ground of the power that they have. I mean, I don't know how reliable all the pictures are, but apparently they've got American tanks and helicopters and trucks and heavy weapons, and they're taking that stuff back to Syria. So, seems like Nusra's not going to have much of a choice but to go along with what they want now. And all as Obama, I still can't get over it. I mean, I know what's going on here, so do you, but still, to see the president say, yeah, ISIS is a big problem in Syria, as he said on the White House lawn the other day, ISIS is a big problem in Syria. Yeah, that's why we need to support the rebels there. Huh? You're crazy. I can't believe that that's the narrative they're sticking with there. You know, over at the National Interest and at other places that are, you know, by no means fringe or alternative media or anything like that, there are people in mainstream kind of foreign policy writings who are challenging this narrative and saying, hey, okay, it's time to, you know, at least speak with an honest appraisal of the facts of who's who here and what to do. And I'm not endorsing backing Assad, but they are. But at least I'm just saying they're acknowledging the truth of saying, look, Assad is our natural ally in this. Why are we backing ISIS in Syria but opposing them in Iraq? It's crazy. And again, I'm not saying that we should ally with Iran and Syria and the Shiites against them. But at least that would be consistent with trying to oppose these guys rather than outright backing them. I think still it would make matters worse by identifying America with the mullahs and the ayatollahs in Iran and with the Alawites and the Shiites in Syria in a way to, you know, just help Baghdadi's recruitment that much more. Same thing with the drone wars. And you know what? It's, you know as well as I do, it's the same damn thing since Woodrow Wilson. Each war creates a crisis, creates the excuse for the next war and the next war and the next war, the next intervention and the next intervention and the next intervention. To the point where now they're on both sides of an Al-Qaeda war with the Shiites. And who in the hell wants to be on either side of that, much less on both sides of it? You know? It's crazy. And yeah, I mean, in the chat room, they're going, what? If we'd only backed ISIS more in Syria, they would not have done this in Iraq. Huh? Please start making sense, TV. You're killing me. I feel your pain, dude. I'm with you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all. Well, I don't know what's wrong with you. You want to hear it from me, but this is my show, the Scott Horton Show. Thanks for joining me today. I'm looking at Michelle Flournoy on TV now. If they don't have, you know, Paul Wolfowitz, they have his mirror image. The lady who lost the Afghan war. Well, tell us, from your expertise in losing a war, Miss Flournoy, what we should do now. You guys are so great at losing wars. How can we lose this next one? Oh, well. You know, Rolodexes are very limiting. It's not like you can have a computer program that keeps track of more than one Rolodex worth of contact information. Paul Wolfowitz, Michelle Flournoy. Who else is there for them to talk to? I don't know. Makes sense. If you lost a war, your name goes in the Rolodex. And if you were opposed to the war all along and you said exactly what would happen and why that was a reason not to do it and you got it all right, then they still never heard of you after all this time. Ain't that fun? Michelle Flournoy of the Center for New American Security, which is just the exact same thing as PNAC, only for the Democrats. The liberal internationalists. And you know what? Speaking of liberal internationalism, oh, hell, maybe nobody cares, but I think it's kind of interesting. If you go look and scroll back through yesterday's tweets of mine, you'll find a link to this article in the New York Times all about Robert Kagan, who is William Kristol's sidekick, co-author of Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy in 1996, and, of course, married to Victoria Nuland, who helped engineer the coup in, they call it democracy in this New York Times piece, it's hilarious, but the coup d'etat in Ukraine in February, and his brother is Fatneck Fred, who, you know, was the pretty face on the surge in Iraq in 2007, and then sort of kind of again with the surge in Afghanistan. It wasn't really his strategy, but they had him write up a thing for the AEI pretending it was his idea and whatever. And anyway, so there's Fred, and then Kimberly Kagan is the head of the Institute for the Study of War now. That's her new think tank, and that's Fred Kagan's wife. And so anyway, but more importantly, Robert Kagan is really the intellectual ringleader of the Klan. And the father, Donald Kagan, I guess, was a historian and a famous anti-communist, right? But all these guys, they're either former communists or the sons or students of former communists who became the right-wing warmongers. They're the neocons, the neoconservatives. If you had to put one of these fat-headed idiots on a poster, you might very well choose Robert Kagan, the guy who was wrong about everything because he was so smart, he knew just what to do and blew up everything, and has a new book out called, Hey, Just Because I Blew Up Everything and Ruined Everything and Destroyed America's Power and Influence in the World by 9,000% doesn't mean that we can quit now. Superpowers can't retire. We gotta double down. Wrote a new essay about it in the New Republic not long ago as well. But in this article with the New York Times, oh, I'm getting to the point. You just be patient. In this article in the New York Times, he says, well, I don't like being called a neoconservative. I like the term liberal internationalism. Ha! Exactly. See? That's what's wrong with these neocons. These far right-wing Republican warmongers, they're a bunch of damn Democrats. They're all a bunch of Hillary Clintons posing as Republicans. A very worst kind of warmongers around. Liberals. From Woodrow Wilson straight all the way through. Isn't that what Max Boot, the former member of the Social Democrats USA Trotskyite group, who now writes for commentary in the Wall Street Journal and all this time? Isn't that what he called it? Hard Wilsonianism. We're like Woodrow Wilson, only we're really violent. Really? Because I could have swore he got us into World War I, invaded Mexico and Bolivia, the Dominican Republic. Are you crazy? You're like Woodrow Wilson, only violent? God dang. Well, you can see the rivers of blood. Take Max Boot at his word. Not that he would go fight himself. That's for you and your boy. Not for Max, somebody else's boots on the ground over there, Boot. In fact, if you just Google the term, I know I go on these tangents, but they're fun. Just Google death in the Wall Street Journal, and you'll see a quote from Max Boot crying about how George W. Bush is waging a push-button war in Afghanistan, shooting cruise missiles and hiring out the fighting to the Northern Alliance. Now, what's his problem? That you're letting Osama get away or something like that? No. His problem was the American people need blood sacrifice to believe that they're in this game. Here, let's find the damn quote. It's so much fun. I was going to talk about Gabriel Kolko this segment, but that's going to wait because I'm going to talk about the neocons some more. Let's see. Death and... It's not too subtle. You'll see the quote. Journal by Justin Raimondo here. Oh, if you type in death in the Wall Street Journal, boy, it comes up with way too much, right? Okay, sorry, wait a minute. Let me add Justin. Blam. And now, death in the Wall Street Journal at antiwar.com. Wall Street Journal editor Max Boot bemoans lack of American casualties in Afghanistan, November 19th, 2001. Here you go. Let's take a look at Max Boot's, quote, "The victory may haunt us." An article which ran in the November 14th, 2001 edition of the Wall Street Journal. Subtitled, "Winning Still Requires Getting Bloody." This paean to the virtues of bloodletting makes the monstrous argument that America suffered too few casualties in the Afghan war for our own good. This is November 19th, 2001. And Max Boot had written on the 14th, actually, quote, "This is not a war being won with American blood and guts. It is being won with the blood and guts of the Northern Alliance, helped by copious quantities of American ordnance and a handful of American advisors. After September 11th, President Bush promised that this would not be another bloodless push-button war, but that is precisely what it has been." There you go. That's called liberalism. And now the truth is, if you go far enough to the left, you'll find hardcore, principled anti-imperialists and anti-war people, and I'm not trying to paint that broad of a brush. I'm not saying I'd rather have communists in charge of the government or anything, because they suck on a lot of other things, but they sure are good on American foreign policy. Usually they're just outright against all of it, so that's good. But the liberals, they're pretty mean. That's the story that Raimondo tells. It's not a perfect narrative, you know, but that's the story Raimondo tells in Reclaiming the American Right, is that it used to be the conservatives who were anti-war, and it was the liberals who believed in the power and the efficacy of the government and the and are not sanctimonious whatsoever about natural rights. Not anymore. Not any more than the conservatives, that's for sure. And so are willing to just grab a sledgehammer and smash the world to remake it however the hell they please. And just like Murray Rothbard wrote in World War One and the Intellectuals. What is it called? I think it's just World War One and the Intellectuals. The fulfillment of their emotions or some crap. Well, I'll find it in a minute. But anyway, there you go. Robert Kagan, he says it himself. Looks like Richard Pearl's still a card-carrying Democrat himself, too.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And yes, it's true, right-wingers typically are worse on foreign policy nowadays. But I do think it's interesting, it's worthy of note, that it's really the so-called, at least, centrists who are the extremists. You know, William Crystal's father, Irvin Crystal, wrote a book called Two Cheers for Capitalism. In other words, they're compassionate conservatives. They're centrists. George Bush, not a former leftist, but still fit in perfect with the neoconservatives. Because being former leftists, they're still real squishy on a lot of liberal issues. And so, you know, John McCain, you know, right-wingers have always hated John McCain because to them, he's a liberal Republican. He may be from Arizona, but he ain't no Goldwater. He's more like Rockefeller. He's a damn liberal, centrist Republican. Barack Obama, look at him. Never mind all the hype about his afro and his, you know, revolutionary black fist in the air and all that crap. He's actually a half-white, conservative Democrat. A centrist, an extremist, who agrees with John McCain on virtually everything. In fact, maybe they differ on matters of degree, but when it comes to all the very worst things that our government does to us and the whole world every day, these guys are of like mind. They're doing the exact same thing. George Bush is the same way. George Bush was the compassionate conservative. Bill Clinton was the DLC Democrat, the new Democrat. The conservative, centrist Democrat. And you might notice that rather than being the moderates, all these guys are the extremists. Now, they're extremists, you know, on the right and the left, but those aren't the ones with the power. And in fact, when it comes to finding anybody who opposes any of this madness, they can usually only be found on the fringes or among the libertarians who are sort of outside your whole ridiculous left-right mess. Thank goodness for us. You know, the fact that the neocons, I mean, this is probably new to at least some liberals, that the neocons, what makes them neocons is that they come from the left, and they're still kind of liberals, and that's why they're so hawkish. They're like Truman Democrats. You know, they're like Ku Klux Klan progressives. That's what they are. They're madmen who believe in the power of the state to make things their way. And yeah, Ku Klux Klan progressives, that's a thing. That's what I'm saying. These categories get mixed up in your mind, you know? But, well, activist government is not just a liberal project. Ask Mussolini, he'll explain it to you. Or read Murray Rothbard about the origins of fascism in America. This one, the one I was trying to think of, you can forgive me for why I couldn't think of the title right correctly off the top of my head with the clock ticking. World War One as Fulfillment, Power and the Intellectuals. And this is all about, well, who led us into war? The New Republic. And, the original Max Boot, Woodrow Wilson. And the thing is, too, I was going to talk about Gabriel Kolko, but it's all one good discussion here to go right into what I was going to say about Gabriel Kolko. The Washington Post finally caught up and ran an obituary of Gabriel Kolko. And it's cool because they say something important here. To me, it's so important. And this is just so eye-openingly, mind-changingly important to me. It seems so significant, I try to point it out any chance I get, you know? And I'll just read it from what the Post wrote here, because they get it, right? Dr. Kolko became widely known in intellectual circles for his books, The Triumph of Conservatism, A Reinterpretation of American History, 1900 through 1916, and Railroads and Regulations, 1877 through 1916, two volumes in which he argued that the progressive era was not nearly as progressive as was suggested in prevailing notions of history. Government leaders had not been trust-busted for the benefit of the public, he argued. Rather, they had pursued regulatory policies that ultimately benefited big business by limiting upstart competitors and cementing industry as a powerful force in American politics. Quote, as new competitors sprang up, and as economic power was diffused throughout an expanding nation, he wrote, it became apparent to many important businessmen that only the national government could rationalize the economy. And then they go on to talk about what a great writer he was on war, his theories of the Vietnam War. He was a very serious historian in the school of William Appleton Williams and the New Left Revisionists of the 1960s, and I guess 50s and 60s. Or maybe 60s and 70s. Anyway, so he wrote all about Vietnam. He wrote all about the American Empire, all about World War II. And he was a friend of this show. I interviewed him, I guess, 3 or 4 or 5 times or something about the wars, about the empire, about Palestine. He had written some articles for Counterpunch. He was a contributor to antiwar.com. But anyway, for me, this is such an important insight that, to oversimplify it, that the right just used the left. They just judoed the crap out of the left. And they said, oh, you know, you don't want to be a happy, celebratory servant of our power? Fine. Go ahead and oppose us by empowering the state. You sure will show us. Oh, yeah, you'll soak the rich. And so it was all one of those don't throw me in the briar patch kind of a scams. Oh, please don't sick the national government on us. However will we confront their awesome power, cried big business, when of course they always owned the national government, and now they just had more of it to own, to use against their competitors. And Kolko, again, he was a new left historian, a post-Marxist, some kind of leftist, wrote a book called After Socialism. But, he didn't, I guess he thought it was fun or something in a way. He didn't resent it, but he certainly wasn't a libertarian just because libertarians quoted him. And I know they wrote a thing in Reason where he was saying, stop citing me favorably, I don't like you people, kind of a thing. But he ended up, that was years and years ago, he ended up coming to appreciate the fact that the Rothbardians took, us libertarians, took such a special interest in his work, that the progressive era, as Anthony Gregory puts it much better than me, but he says basically that liberals, because of the influence of Marxism mostly, they adopted the conservative means of state power for achieving their liberal ends. They just couldn't believe that freedom was getting the job done. They weren't willing to wait around for it. And it's not like they were existing in a free market. They lived in a mixed economy anyway, where it's just all welfare and rigged game on behalf of the powerful. So it amounted to a scam. Not that everybody who believed in progressivism 100 years ago was a complete idiot or whatever, but basically what it amounted to was one giant judo maneuver where the conservatives won, big business won, and some poor got their socialism paid off with their own money, basically, to tolerate living in a fascist country, an imperial, a global empire, the most corrupt and violent force on the planet today, really. To me, it's a very important part of history. I wanted to bring up Colonel House because M. Strong in the chat room brought up Colonel House, but that's an important part of the story as well. Woodrow Wilson's Cheney was a fascist.
Hey, Al Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at LibertyStickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at LibertyStickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at TheBumperSticker.com. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Yeah, I see where, I guess I retweeted something I saw yesterday about Left and Right, The Prospects for Liberty by Murray Rothbard. It's the audio. I saw somebody just retweeted that. And in there, he talks all about Gabriel Kolko and the libertarian analysis of FDR and Wilson, not as socialist, but as fascist. And the progressives as basically being the useful idiots of the conservatives in, you know, being the cheering cries for a big regulatory state. And now, I know it sounds counterintuitive, especially if you're just born hating billionaires, which makes sense, right? That doesn't seem right. I should have to work so hard and they don't, or whatever people think. If you're born just resenting power, they drill it into your head that the only way to ever get back at big corporations you hate or anything like that is to hire the government to take care of them for you, to keep them in line, to use your democracy and your power and whatever. But the thing is, and you've heard of this probably, regulatory capture. Well, once the government starts regulating an industry, then the industry works really hard to control the regulators, and then they end up capturing it, and they bend the regulations just to serve their will and protect them from their enemies in the market and et cetera, like that. Their enemies in court. Well, that's what the whole state is in the first place. That's what, certainly in the progressive era and the creation of the regulatory state, that's what it all is. The regulatory commission was created by the railroads. The Federal Reserve was created by the bankers. The Food and Drug Administration was created by the biggest meatpacking industry, companies in the, yeah, and on and on. What Kolko calls the rationalization is him agreeing with big business, which I disagree with this, that the fact that their prices kept changing on them and was screwing them up meant that something had to be done, and anyway, but let's call it what it is. But the truth is, there was a big trend, and he says this too, there was this huge trend, this idea, an ideology even, among big businessmen at the time that they wanted to create these just incredible conglomerates, these huge combines of industry that were then top-heavy and unable to work well in the market. Prices were dictating that they spin these companies off or fold them and move on, and they didn't want to do that. Or you know, prices in the market were saying that they better innovate to compete with their new competitors who are rising up elsewhere in the country. They didn't want to do that. They just wanted to hire the state. Anyway, if you read it from Rothbard, you'll get it a hell of a lot better than from me. But might as well, back to Philip Drew for a minute, or Colonel Edward Mandel House. He was the Dick Cheney to Woodrow Wilson, if Wilson was Bush, which is pretty close, nitwit. Then House was Dick Cheney, who told them what to do and who got the Federal Reserve Act passed and negotiated American entry into World War I 2 years before the actual entry into World War I, a year before the election. And anyway, he wrote a book called Philip Drew Administrator, which I always like to urge people to read. And it's basically just, I mean, it's a terrible novel, don't get me wrong. I don't mean read it because of what great writing it is. But the point is, it's, you know, it'd be like if Karl Rove wrote a book about and wrote it in 1999 about, this is how I want to, you know, destroy everything, allow a giant terrorist attack, and then use it as an excuse to invade Iraq and torture people and spy on everyone. And he just had admitted it all in a book published anonymously 2-3 years before implementing the policy. That's what happened with Colonel House in the book Philip Drew. It's his dream of America as a fascist dictatorship under his rule. And yes, there is a skate park in Austin named after the guy. It's a government skate park, but it's kind of fun. But anyway, the thing of it is, there's a barbecue place named after him, too, and a football stadium, and a park. the park first, and then the rest. Yeah. He wrote Philip Drew in Austin, by the way, in West Campus, just, you know, right there by Lamar and 15th Street. That's why that's where the park there is named after. That's why the park there is named after, because that's right around there he wrote part of Philip Drew. Anyway, if you read that, you'll see that this whole thing about central banking, progressive income tax, and pensions for old people, and let's put labor unions and government bureaucrats on the boards of directors of every company, that one didn't quite fly. But even more to the point, that just goes to show. Here was a guy who praised Mussolini and, in fact, was jealous and said, but I came up with this stuff before him. I anticipated Mussolini by several years, he insisted. That this is the triumph of conservatives. And if you read the book, you see that, yeah, they all end up working with the big businessmen at the end. It's not a communist overthrow. It's an overthrow of the corruption of the old republic that had to be replaced by this new fascist dictatorship. It's called Philip Drew Administrator, A Story of Tomorrow by Colonel Edward Mandel House, who, again, was behind ushering through the Federal Reserve Act and then helping to set up and to pick and choose the people who would run the economy, the wartime economy during World War I, and didn't have his falling out with Wilson until the Treaty of Versailles at the end of the war. So it was extremely influential that whole time. And so anyway, so there you go. Modern day liberalism is a big scam. The whole left-right thing, in effect, it's a scam, but also really kind of in origin. The modern, you know, we still live with the 20th century left-right, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat parties. Of course, the parties have switched and the coalitions have changed a bit. But it's mostly pretty consistent since like the 70s or the 80s when all the when the last of the conservatives became Republicans, left the Southern conservatives, left the Democrats. Been pretty consistent since then on that, you know, kind of basic split. But in terms of, you know, conservatism meaning the use of state power to keep things as they are for the people who already have it the way they want it, yeah, that's modern liberalism is that exact same scam. Again, that's why you find all the extremists in the center, like Madman John McCain and blood-soaked Barack Obama. Hey, did you like that? I just did that right there on the thing with the little alliteration there. Yeah, these guys, that probably wasn't very original, but it was to me just now. Not to beg or anything, but yeah, really. I felt very poetic. The centrists are the extremists. The libertarians, who are the radicals, I'm not calling libertarians conservatives at all, because we sure as hell ain't. But we're the ones who are opposed to all of that. We're the ones who want, and it sounds counterintuitive to a liberal at first, but we want to force all of the big automakers, the big bankers, agribusiness, weapons manufacturers, everybody else, we want to make them compete in a free market. Now, to a liberal, that sounds like set them free to get away with more murder, but that ain't right. It turns out that it's not libertarianism. It's conservatism and liberalism that are the rich white man's anarchy, where they get to do whatever they want. Libertarianism, it doesn't say enslave them, the rich white men, but it says no more handouts, no more special protections, no more pretending that the regulatory state is to protect us from them when that just ain't so. It's the other way around. Make them compete in a free market. And just look, I mean, we're talking about GM killing all these people. I read one yesterday where a lady in Fort Worth, the prosecutors put her in prison on a manslaughter charge when her GM car turned off on her ass on a flaw that they knew was in her ignition system all this time. Well, that company would have ceased to exist. It's not like individuals there are ever going to be held accountable and go to prison for this kind of thing anyway. But that country would have ceased to exist. That company would have ceased to exist years ago if the government didn't keep propping it up. And yet they've been killing people. And with impunity, because they're basically an arm of the Labor Department or whatever crap now. Citigroup would not be Citigroup. J.P. Morgan Chase would not be J.P. Morgan Chase. Goldman would not be Goldman in a free market. They would be probably gone at least they'd be spun off into 100 pieces. Abolish the state, and then you'll get at the corporations you hate. Again, with the rhyming.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. CNI stands against America's negative role in the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the war party's relentless push to bomb Iran, and the roles played by twisted Christian Zionism and neocon-engineered Islamophobia in justifying it all. But they can't do it without you. Support CNI's push to straighten out America's crooked course. Check out the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click Donate under About Us at the top of the page.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And I wasn't keeping track, but I saw on Twitter today that today was the first anniversary of the death of Michael Hastings. So I wanted to remark that he was a great reporter. And you should read what he wrote. A lot of it was really good. And in fact, the article that got McChrystal fired was really good for a lot of other reasons besides that. Really worth your time. Will really help enhance your understanding of the Iraq War. And of course, he's the guy that wrote the article on Bergdahl. He wrote one. Wasn't perfect, but it was good enough for my purposes. It had what I needed in there, man, about the decision-making process in the White House as they decided to go to war with Libya in 2011. And a lot more than that. They're releasing a new novel. And yes, he was the kind of great reporter that we know for a fact, Jason Leopold and them approved it through the FOIA, that the FBI was watching him. They got his FBI file, and they were investigating him because of his work on Bo Bergdahl. He knew so much more about it than they did, so there's that. And supposedly, and probably true, I don't know. And I don't know all the details, but he was working on something about the CIA or something about Petraeus at the time. When he died, my first instinct was even that the JSOC murdered him just for revenge for McChrystal. But then again, you know, that's assuming a lot. I don't know. Obviously, yes, very computerized cars such as his are hackable. On the other hand, his wife and his brother both say that they're confident that it was just a wreck. And so, if it's good enough for his brother and for his wife, then that's good enough for me, you know? Just because the government might have wanted to see him dead doesn't mean that they're the ones who killed him. I'm sure a lot of them were relieved. But anyway, I'd rather, because I'm willing to take his brother's judgment on that. And his brother gave an extended interview with, I guess, a family friend with a blog or something, where they just, that's the end of that for me. So I can put that aside. I'll recommend that to you if you want. But I will tell you that if you go back and listen to my interviews with Michael, you'll find out that he really knew what he was talking about. And as I've said before, I feel like an idiot because I never finished his book. I had so much other stuff going on at the time. I never finished the book, The Operators, but then I was embarrassed to have him back on the show because I hadn't finished reading his book, and then like 3 years went by, and then he was dead. So that was really stupid because, you know, I could get that guy on the phone, it'd be the middle of the night in Afghanistan, and he would let me interview him about what the hell was going on over there and stuff. He was really great, and so I really let that acquaintanceship and friend of the show-ness thing going on there fall apart, to my shame. But damn, it just kills me that he's not alive right now, because he would be so kicking ass. Surely Greenwald would have shared the documents with Hastings on some level anyway. And he would have been the Tasmanian devil this past couple of years. And he certainly would be on my list of people who I can call who can talk about Iraq like they know about it, which he did, because he covered it there on Embedded. And he was really good, and he was a go-to guy. Even if he hadn't written something about Iraq, something happened in Iraq, I knew I could get him on and that he would know exactly what the hell he was talking about. So anyway, I just, you know, rest in peace and all that stuff that people say. I don't know, it just sucks. He was a great reporter, and if he'd lived to be 80, just think of the stories that he would have broken. absolutely fearless kind of a journalist. Anyway, so bye, dude. Yeah, okay. And then I want to talk about too this piece in Foreign Policy in Focus. It's about Somalia. Bad news. Unfortunately, the person who wrote this in Foreign Policy in Focus does not understand that it's bad news. But that's okay. The news is what's the news. Not the spin in this piece. And I didn't even know this, man. I mean, hell, I can't know everything, I guess. The Obama administration's Somali pivot. Aw, man. They've gone from something they call in their government new speak constructive disengagement. Is that what you call it? Jesus. Now they're going for engagement. Oh, crap. The four pillars. Man, they always have to have a name, a construction for all their crap. They can't just be honest about what they're doing. The four pillars. We have to strengthen democratic institutions, support economic growth and development, and advance peace and security, and promote opportunity and development. In other words, spend money killing people and hiring people to kill other people. That's it. That's what they're going to do. They're invading Africa because they need something to do. The spies, the military, they need something to do. And Africa, to them, is just a virgin to exploit. It's on. If you're new to the subject, I'll beg you to go read Nick Turse. Please go read Nick Turse. Please, pretty please. Just type in Turse, T-U-R-S-E, and Africa. And then read about 5 or 6 or 10 of those things. And then, yeah, then you'll know. It's a bad time coming. I mean, it's already begun, don't get me wrong. There's now more than a military mission a day on the continent of Africa. But it's only just going to get worse. But anyway, so this article is about how on June the 3rd, Wendy Sherman, the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, announced they're ratcheting up their support for Somalia, which eventually will mean more and more support for the Kenyans, the Ethiopians, the Burundians, the Ugandans, their militaries, under the auspices of the African Union, to occupy this place and to fight al-Shabaab, which, if history is any guide, will only make them stronger. And will only help create more enemies. More excuses for America to fight even further. And you can see the blowback as recent as yesterday and the day before that. Attacks in Kenya that, as they say, are a response. Tit for tat. For Kenyan African Union troops and their attacks against Somalis and against al-Shabaab in Somalia. If George Bush had just said, who cares? Send one of these nitwits over there to sit at a table and make a deal with the Islamic Courts Union back in 2005 and 6. That would have been fine. They were a bunch of conservative old men. They weren't radical, you know. They weren't Arabian kooks. They weren't Al-Qaeda. And if America had just left them alone, there never would have been al-Shabaab in the first place. And then ever since they intervened, and really, I mean, they created, even that's skipping ahead. It's been ever since 9/11 that they went back to Somalia. But anyway, they just keep making it worse and worse and worse. And then, starting with the Ethiopian invasion of 06, sponsored by the USA, that was when al-Shabaab really came into being. It was the smallest, you know, least effective part of the Islamic Courts Union. And yet, they were the young men with the rifles, so when it came to the war, they were the ones who fought, and they were the ones who defeated the Ethiopians and drove them out of the country. And then when their leaders in the Islamic Courts Union compromised with Condoleezza Rice to come to power in Somalia, they kept fighting and said, you guys are traitors, and after all that we did for you, and so now we're going to keep fighting you, and now this al-Shabaab militia's been running around cutting people's hands off and acting like crazy wannabe al-Qaeda guys this whole time. And then, as I mentioned the other day, and it's really important, the Americans sponsored the Kenyan intervention in 2012. And in 2013, or maybe it was in 2012, the Kenyans kicked al-Shabaab out of the port town of Kismayo. And they had a charcoal business going on there that was making them all their money, and they had their own little kind of mini city-state going on. And so, well, that has to be stopped. So they send in the Kenyans with American money to attack Kismayo and drive the al-Shabaab creeps out. But then what happened? Well, they didn't have their charcoal business anymore, so they needed money. So what they do? They went to the Saudi princes and said, yeah, we'll internationalize our movement and fall in line more with your goals if you'll pay us. And so all it helped to do is make the fiction true that al-Shabaab was part of al-Qaeda and part of the bin Ladenite movement in America. It's truer than ever before, anyway. And now they're going to make matters even worse. Anyway, have a good day. See y'all tomorrow.